We've had this tradition of asking some of our poets, as a first question, what the most exciting piece of mail that they recently received is. So if you'd like to share.
Well, when was it? This was like maybe July of this past summer. And my first a bit of backstory for it, because I'm just like, oh, somebody sent me a letter. That, of course, that's what happens, right, when you get mail. But so my first book, Honey Voiced, which I mentioned in the bio, came out last November 15, 2014. And it deals with it with the fragments of the Greek poet Sappho. We just have fragments of her. So what I did was I took the fragments in Greek and translated them into English, and then wrote a poem around that.
Great.
So, I mean, I was, you know, here I was a senior in college, doing this thing. I'm not even a classics major. I studied English. I taught myself ancient Greek just to read Sappho. It's a little crazy. Long story. But, so, the point is, one of the, Emeritus classics professors at Kenyon, who I never had class with, you know, I saw him readings and things, but to me he was just, you know, one of the professors who lived there. I never saw him at, like, in class or anything. He translated Sappho with Willis Barnstone. They put out their translation as Sweet Bitter Love. Came out in paperback a few years ago, I think like 2009. I wrote the book. I magically got in touch with Willis Barnstone. He read the book. He blurbed it. It was wonderful. And then this past July, I wake up and my parents, I live with my parents over the summer because I, you know, grad school and whatnot. I don't really have my own place yet. And my mom says, you have mail from, like, a professor. And I'm like, oh, well, that's a momentous occasion, right, if a professor sends you a letter. And I go down and I open it, and I don't recognize the handwriting. It's really faint, like, on it's like pencil on paper. I don't recognize the handwriting. I read the letter, and, like, two sentences into the letter, I find out that it's from, like, I realize that it's from Bill McCullough, Professor McCullough, who, like, he's like a legitimate actual Sappho scholar, who's telling me that one of my English professors finished my book and gave him her copy, and so, like, now he's writing to me to, like, thank me for writing it. And it was just fantastic to be like, oh, hey, this guy who, you know, he must be in his, like, mid-80s, right?
Right.
So it's like this guy who's in his mid-80s, who's been, you know, translating Greek poetry all his life, read, you know, because I started writing the poems when I was a junior in college, so, like, 3 years ago. So it's, you know, he read what I wrote, and I'm not even his student because I saw him around campus, but that doesn't mean we had any sort of relationship. And he wrote me this, like, letter gushing about how, like, I was his favorite translation of Sappho. So I ended up framing the letter, and it's hanging over my desk at home.
Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah. That's great.
Sorry, my stories tend to ramble.
Oh, no, that's great. That's great. Well, actually, so that contextualizes a different question. So I'm going to skip ahead to a question that deals a little bit with brevity. So Red Flag specializes in, you know, what we can fit on a postcard. And
right.
and that's what we like. And, you know, hearing you talk about Sappho and the fragmentary nature of Sappho really... This isn't part of that collection, but this is reminiscent of a kind of fragmentary art, because these short poems, there's so much left unsaid, you know, and Sappho, of course, unintentionally, but for you and your work, in this case, at least, intentionally. Do you want to speak to the benefits, difficulties, the aesthetic of that short kind of poem?
Of the short poem, I can try. It's kind of a big subject, not to belabor the point, but I suppose poetry. Like, getting a little broader for a second, but poetry itself tends to pack, you know, a lot of meaning into fewer lines than, say, you would probably have if you were writing a novel or a memoir or what have you. So I feel like, and which is not to say that long poems are, you know, quote-unquote bad.
Right.
Or that all short poems are good, because as I'm sure you guys know, that is not the case.
Yeah, we've had one or two, yeah.
You know, but I think I hit upon this sort of like short form, which is the three line, so it's like just a tercet, like a free verse tercet thing. I hit on that while writing the Sappho book.
Sure.
And I mean some of the poems in the Sappho book are three lines, but I didn't really start exploring it until I finished that, because that had like its own aesthetic, and I mean it was me because I wrote it, but at the same time, you know, if you're putting words in a poet's mouth and that poet has been dead for 3,000 years, you can't go around talking about how, like, your iPhone broke and you're sad or what have you, you know?
Sure.
So there was a little, it was a different voice. It wasn't, like, my voice. But now that I've finished with that, that project, what I'm writing now, and I guess I'm kind of answering another one of the questions, because I think one of the questions was, what are you working on?
Your larger body of work, sure, yeah.
Right. So I'll try to answer both of the questions. So what I'm working on now is I'm getting an MFA in poetry at Stony Brook, Southampton. It's a SUNY school. And what my thesis is going to be, and what I'm hoping my next full-length collection is a series of poems all dealing with the senses in some way, mostly around food and drink.
Okay.
But, for example, this poem, Forecast, isn't about food or drink, but I feel like it's still very much about the senses. It's,
sure, yeah.
And so I'm hoping to include it somewhere in the new manuscript, which I'm tentatively titling Epicurotica. So, mm-hmm. Like, Epicurean erotica, but it's a portmanteau that a friend of mine came up with over the summer, and I'm terrible at titles, so I tend to just delegate my titles to other people.
Gotcha.
Honey Voiced, my book, but that wasn't my title. That was one of Sappho's fragments.
Sure.
So I just translated it, and I was like, oh, hey, a title.
right. Yeah, that's a great title.
About short, like how short poetry works. I feel like if you can condense the emotion into like the fewest lines possible, it's more memorable, because it's easier for people to remember and recite. I'm big on oral poetry, so it's easier for people to, you know, remember and recite a three-line poem than it is for them to like recite the Odyssey,
or
whatever. And also, if you manage to do it in a short space, I feel like the emotion, like, since you're packing so much emotion into it, into three lines or two lines or 10 lines, whatever, you're packing so much emotion into it, it just feels more loaded in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
There's this W.S. Merwin poem, which is three lines. It's called Separation. Mm-hmm. And it's, your absence has gone through me like a thread through a needle. Everything I do is stitched with its color.
Wow, yeah.
And just when I heard him read it, Kenyon, in the fall of 2010, and he read that, and just since then, it's just been, like, bouncing around my head for 5 years, you know?
Right.
And I feel like that poem does everything I want my poems to do. It's short, really easy to memorize, and, like, I'm one of those obnoxious English majors who will pepper their conversations with poetry.
Right.
So it's not obnoxious, I suppose, when you're with other English majors, but
yeah.
Some people might be like, dude, you know, chill it with the Keats or what have you.
So
short poems are good, I think.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, aesthetically, Franz Wright has a poem, I think it's called Hell, that I like a lot, and it's like that too, and I can't recite it, but the idea is that if you suffer long enough, don't you become the holy something like that, and it's only, I think it's three or four lines, and it had a similar impact on me. So, and I think that, you know, aesthetically, that's much of our aim at Red Flag, you know. So great. So I'll backtrack. Then, and you might have already answered this too, but is there a poet or a,
answer it again.
Is there a poet or a poem that you claim as your biggest influence?
There's a lot of poets and poems I would claim as an influence. I don't know about biggest. I really like Pablo Neruda. And I know that's probably a very stock answer when you're dealing with lyric poets, but I've been doing a lot of translation, like reading about translation, and I speak Spanish and French, and I'm hoping to pursue further like studies in translation theory or whatnot, but I feel like. Particularly Neruda's, he has a couple of books of all the odes. I mean, I know you hear about, like, the Ode to My Socks is probably one of the most famous ones, where he takes just these random household objects, you know, the socks that one of his friends knitted for him. He has an ode to wine, which isn't so much about the wine as, like, the wine glass. And how that, you know, he ends up comparing the wine glass to, like, the body of the perfect woman or something like that. So, sadly, he's very dead now. So he took these, you know, household objects and found art in them and, I think it's just when you hear him, when you read him, he's wonderful. When you hear him recited by somebody who really, like, believes in Neruda, if that's possible. I mean, it's almost like this quasi-religious experience, you know, where, like, one of my professors at Kenyon was very into Neruda. She said he was over-translated, but...
Right.
That didn't, because, you know, like, everybody translates Neruda, but I think he's still definitely worth reading.
Sure.
If only for that ecstasy of, you know, like I said, just that like, poem about the socks, it's just, like, he's really fucking happy.
Right, yeah.
That, like, his friend knitted him a pair of socks, and, like, he goes on for, talk about long poems, I think he goes on for, like, 3 pages. About how, like, flipping awesome these socks are.
Yeah.
And you finish reading the poem, and you're sad because nobody's ever given you a pair of socks.
Right.
You know? And so it's like that. I feel like it's just that passion.
Right.
That I hope to somehow sublimate into my own life.
Right.
So we were also wondering where you think the role of poetry is in everyday life, right? As you've already kind of mentioned, we frequently, outside of the sphere of English majors, you can't really recite poetry that often without being questioned for your sanity. But,
which is why you should just hang out with English majors. But, you know.
So where do you think, if there is one, the role of poetry in everyday life is? Like, what should we do with poetry as we move forward in reality, I guess?
You mean, well, this could go a couple different ways.
What
should we as poets do with poetry, or we as, like...
Well, I mean, that question in the past has been asked as, you know, what is a poet? So that's another way to approach it. So really, go with your gut, and we'll listen.
I mean, I think it's just, like, for me, because I feel like I can't really say, oh, you know, like, I'm going to answer for this random person on the street.
Sure.
For me, poetry is a way to, like, I mentioned, you know, having a quasi-religious experience when reading Neruda. I won't go so far as to pull a Ginsberg and say that he appeared to me when I was, like, in bed and reading him, you know, because he did that with William Blake.
Right.
But I feel like just reading a poem, that doesn't really matter to me if, you know, the poet, like, if you just had lunch with the poet yesterday, or if you're reading something from, you know, 3,000 years ago and in another language. Experiencing poetry, whether you read it or hear it, enables you to connect with somebody. Doesn't really matter if they're living or dead. And so I feel like you connect with the poet, and in doing so, you also connect with all the other people who have connected with the poet.
That's true.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I know some of my best friends, and then again, maybe it's because, you know, they're weird English majors like myself, but I've made some of my best friends by just, like, hanging out at poetry readings and whatnot, and, like, they'll read something by, I don't know, say, whatever poet pops into your head, and I also read something by that poet, and so it's a topic of conversation that, you know, you're like, oh, you like this poet, I like this poet too, let's talk, and eventually that blossoms into something else. And I suppose that you could do that even if you didn't write yourself, but as somebody who writes poetry, it's a way to sort of slow down. I feel like I don't write every day because I don't have time to write every day, and because I'm in school, so if I even had time to write every day, it would probably not be so, you know, wouldn't be as good as if I were, like, just some sort of gentleman poet in the 17th century living in my tower and just scribbling away. But, like, by writing poems, you crystallize something that either happened to you or that popped into your head that you wouldn't necessarily be able to do if you just, you know, jotted something down in your journal or texted your friend about it. Like, I feel like poetry is a little bit more deliberate, if that makes sense, than any other sort of form of introspection.
Yeah.
So I think that's all that we have for you. Is there anything else that you want to tell us about your future projects, or anything else that we can look at? You said you have a couple of books. Are they available on Amazon?
I only have the one book.
Okay, that's right. The one.
I'm working on
the other. That's right.
Book.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, it's okay. I wish if you know of a book I've written that I don't know.
Yeah.
Do let me know, because I would like to read it on Amazon. No. So Honey Voiced is available on Amazon.
Okay. And you said you're working on another project right now.
Yes, and I'm working on another project called Epicurotica.
Okay.
Which is this the collection of poems about sort of that deal with food and sensuality and all those wonderful things, which Forecast will probably be a part of. And then there's this thing right now up in the air. I don't know if you guys know Bob Holman. He's the founder of the Bowery Poetry Club in New York City. I met him a couple of weeks ago, and he's into sort of dead and dying languages and languages that need preservation, etc. So I wrote a chapbook of poems about words that don't have a direct translation in English. So, for example, there's the Spanish sobremesa, which is technically means above the table,
mm-hmm.
but what you use it for is like the action of, after finishing a meal, the action of just sitting there with the people you just ate with, and just sort of talking about, you know, anything and everything. And I feel like it's a lot of things like that, which we do as English speakers. You know, you finish eating and you hang out with your friends or your family or whatever. But we don't necessarily have a concept for it.
Right.
And it's like so it's so important in Spain and in Spanish-speaking countries that there's a word for it. And, I mean, it's just a bunch of other words like that. So I talked to Bob Pullman, and he wants to publish it as an Indigenous Word of the Day series mm-hmm. on his Facebook and Twitter.
Nice.
So it's a little unorthodox as far as publications go, but we're sort of in the talks to do that. I told him he could have all of the poems.
Awesome.
Great.
So they'll be coming out soon, too.
Great. We'll look for that.